135. Three members are present, and we might have one online also. Present is Senator Elton, Betty Davis, Chair, and Fred Senator Dyson also. And there's Senator Calgary online. He's not there now, but he probably will come on, and maybe he's celebrating his birthday. Today is his birthday. So everybody wish you happy birthday. Okay, we have two bills coming up before us. We have Senator McGuire here to talk about those bills. Both of them are her bills. We're going to take the bill that has to do with well baby exams first. Okay. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
And before you get started, I'd just like to say that Senator Thomas is Vice Chair is present also.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Davis and members of the Senate HES Committee. This bill has been before you one time last year, and we set it aside to look at some things. It's back before you today, and I'm hoping for passage. It is a bill mandating well baby exam coverage in insured in the insurance policies that are provided. And just a little bit of a anecdote of the history of the bill. When my son was born, when Grayson was born, I went in and did the well baby exam, got the schedule of well baby exams, which is put out by the state, giving you the stepping stones for the vaccinations, along with the times that you know babies should have a checkup for growth, for skill development, and so forth. And so walked through it just like an average citizen, went ahead and submitted that to my insurance company, and when it came back, said 0% paid. And what I found out was, I'm under the state plan, but what I found out is that well baby exams were not covered. And so then I started talking among other mothers and some fathers about well baby exams and them being covered and not. And what I found was that there are quite a few insurance providers that don't cover well baby exams as a matter of course. And so that started me down a path of exploration and research, and then just sort of philosophical discovery. And for me, Madam Chair, as you know, under statute, we do have a few other categories where we have had to mandate insurance coverage. And it is a bit of the state stepping in to the private sector. I would admit that at the outset, that there will be folks that will have a philosophical concern with that. But for me, children can't speak for themselves 0 to 2. They don't have any way to say they're not getting proper nourishment. They don't have any way to ask for a life-saving vaccination that could prevent death or serious illness at a later point in their life. They have no way to speak about proper motor skill development and so forth. And so we know that parents do the very best job they can, and I would never mean to imply that a well baby exam was a substitute for being a good parent. However, having a well baby exam, having 10 good well baby exams between 0 to 24 months is one of those insurance policies against bad health and what we hope is for proper development for our children in Alaska. Many states do this. I think it's the right policy. I've thought long and hard about whether or not it was appropriate to introduce a bill that would mandate insurance coverage. I understand the debate, and you hear it. Others that I have supported in my time here, Senator Davis, that I know have been presented to members of this committee, colorectal cancer screening and diabetes are two examples where I was able to say to myself that the prudent choice, I guess you'd say, on the part of a state policymaker was to ask to take care of Alaskans' health. And right now, what I could do would be to make a vote for those bills that would, in some way, hopefully provide a life-saving option for someone who might not otherwise have it. And it's just a fact of life that the private sector and the market don't always take care of the things that we know as policymakers are important to people. And the last point I want to make is that if economics is a concern, I think this is your bill too. Because I think that what we know about well baby exams and prevention is that it's going to save you a lot of money in the long run to have a child, a developmental need discovered, or perhaps a real serious problem discovered early on in these well baby exams, as opposed to later on when it's an emergency room visit and thousands and thousands of dollars. So I think from a societal standpoint, I think we have an obligation to speak for our children that cannot speak for themselves. I think from a policy standpoint, it's incumbent upon us sometimes to step in where the private sector may not be recognizing the needs of our citizens. And then finally, from an economic standpoint, I think it makes sense to have these exams early on so that we don't have higher costs later down the line. So I'd ask for support of Senate Bill 170.
All right, thank you for that overview of your bill. Do we have any people in the audience who signed up to speak to this bill? Apparently I don't have your names on the list. And I'd like to go...
Senator Cowdery, I'm
online. I'd like to go into that, unless you have your staffer to give some information, I'd go to the public testimony.
Nothing to add. We do have, Madam Chair, we do have a few people available. A couple who would like to offer testimony via teleconference, and then a couple people who are able to answer questions.
All right.
And I do understand that Dr. Budo has actually segmented out a section. She's a pediatrician, and she's actually blocked out a section of her day. And so if the...
She's online?
Yes.
All right. I don't have that list in front of me, but I will get to that. Today I'm going to start with the people that's in the audience. And would somebody come forward and give your name? Okay, they're bringing it to me now.
I'm Dr. George Brown. I live at 1640 2nd Street in Douglas. I'm a pediatrician here in Juneau. And yes. I'm speaking to strongly urge passage of this bill. The American Academy of Pediatrics had some researchers in the 90s look at cost effectiveness of the prevention things that are done in well baby visits. And for every dollar that was spent, roughly $4.50 was saved. I'm delighted to see the bill talks about the many different parts of infant and well child care. But I want to stress that the idea of separating physical and mental health sometimes causes lots of problems for society and for insurers. But an infant and a mother are a combined dyad. They are the start of life. And so many things that can be done early, the support that can be given to the mother and to the parents, which are the things we in pediatrics, our colleagues in general practice who provide well child care, are looking at. In the area of the sad problem of child abuse, it's been clearly shown that if a family has what we call a medical home, in which the family, the parents know, they can go, they can call, they have a relationship, and they feel like they're being supported, that prevents child abuse. So there's every reason for leaders of the state of Alaska to make this investment by making sure that children do have these examinations. And I think back about the times, you know, I've been in Alaska a long time, when Bill Egan, Jay Hammond, you know, some of Wally Heckel, some of the really outstanding leaders of this state have said, we want to do what's best for the citizens of Alaska. This is clearly a way to do that, and I salute Senator McGuire for introducing me. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Yes, Senator.
Thanks for your testimony and your service. Does Medicaid cover well baby exams?
Yes, it does.
And Denali Kid Care?
Yes.
And what do you do with the parents who don't have insurance and don't qualify for Medicare or Denali Kid Care, and you're taking care of their child? Do you strongly recommend that they do pay for the well baby exam?
I can't speak for all my colleagues. I know in my practice here and in all the practices I've had in Alaska, I've never turned anyone away, whether they did or didn't have insurance. But, you know, there's a major factor in this. People have pride. They have a sense of wanting to pay their way. And they will not come if they don't have insurance. And if they come and we try to help them get insurance, they may or they may not. But many times that barrier makes a huge difference. And we pay the price for that later on in society.
I appreciate that. Doesn't really answer my question. So when you do have somebody who, the last three people in Alaska who pay their own bills, do you encourage them to have a well baby exam, and what do you charge them for that?
We encourage everybody to have the well baby exam. We charge the same amount for all the people that come. In many cases, if they don't have insurance and they can't afford to pay for it, we will, you know, negotiate with them to let them pay what they can. Yeah. But we want them all, insurance and no insurance, to be seen.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. Can you give me a rough idea how much that cost?
Well, I think in the bill, she gives the range of the cost, which is pretty much what we all charge, because
Senator Dyson, in the original bill, she had it at $1,500 to cap it off for the year for the examinations. It was removed because some charge more and some charge less, but you're thinking about an average of $1,500 for the 10 visited.
Yes, and that sounds, you know, very reasonable. I didn't see a total. What I saw was the figure. This is in her
statement.
The figure of 125 to 250. Mm-hmm. Our practice, it's in the lower range.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Yes, I'm sorry. Senator Cogry, I'd asked if you were online. I see that you are now. And so we're on 170?
Yes, I've been online listening.
Yes, you have. And also, I just want to say that I told everybody today was your birthday, and we all wish you happy birthday.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I think the chair should sing to it.
You don't want me to do that?
Do other states have this type of mandate on their books?
Some states do and some don't. And I think Senator Thomas said only
21 or 22, I believe.
21 or 22 states have mandated it.
And do the cost of immunizations, do insurance usually cover that cost?
Well, it would be covered in the well baby checks when they have it.
I see.
Okay?
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Any more questions? Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is just kind of a general question or statement that I oftentimes make. We hear a lot about intervention in not only the medical area but in social service fields, having a huge impact on down the road on saving money, you know, saving services. But we never really get the feedback back, or at least I don't, maybe others do, on how that has happened, how it happens, and thereby rewarding us for the decisions that we make. And part of the thing is not all people are as motivated as you are for good purpose. And the insurance companies, I'm not to speak ill of them, but they're a business and they're there to make money. And unless you're able to cause them to believe that this will save money in the long run, and I happen to believe that it does. You know, there's no doubt I support this. That's not a problem. But unless we take a more proactive role in showing, then the premiums will go up. I believe that they simply will just do it and let somebody challenge them on the aspect of that. When we put a mandate in for this type of care for babies and children, early childhood, that it raised costs and raised obviously their risk then of taking that, and so they had to raise premiums, absent us showing that how in the future that the number of the amount of autism and childhood diseases and other chronic diseases that we were able to discover at an early age actually saved money over a period of time. And it would take somebody brighter than me to actually chart all that out. But I think if we were able to do that, then the state, even as it negotiates its health plan, although we're self-insured, I guess, or to a certain degree, but the private insurers would probably, and those that are privately insured, would be more able to argue their case that their premiums should not go up as mandates such as this are put in, requiring services that will in the long run save money and actually establishing that. So I don't know if you have a response to that or not, but that's just what I see, not only in this field but in a variety of other areas, that we know or we believe that these things take place, but we don't take the time to actually prove them, or if that information does exist, the state doesn't use it, or private companies don't use it to argue with their insurance company over these types of things.
Senator Thomas, we might have somebody online that might be able to speak to that rather sure. than have the doctor try to answer
I
that
would
question.
Say that the study that AAP that I referenced was looking at immunizations and preventing injuries in particular, in which they came up with the figure of how much was actually saved. I also would add that I know insurance companies are becoming much more aware of this because they're listening to their customers. And Premier Blue Cross here in Alaska, I've met with some of them, and I know they are paying attention to this. So I think they are coming around, but that's enough that I can say.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. That was a good comment that you say they are aware of it and they are listening to us. And so just to further add to the conversation that Senator Thomas just had, we might be making a mandate, you know, for it to happen. It does not really mean that the premium have to go up. That's up to the insurance company. But the insurance company are doing business in our states, then they also have to know what some of our priorities are. Because if they can't provide what we want, we can always contract to have somebody else provide it. That's the way I feel about it.
Well, mandated hearing exams for the insurance companies.
Yes. So is there... Stephanie Birch, you're online in Anchorage?
Yes, ma'am.
Would you like to sort of speak to the question or the statement that was made by Senator Thomas? Or did you hear?
Madam Chair, his question was, if I'm understanding correctly, his question was regarding the cost effectiveness over time.
Yeah, and how what we do to get the word out to make sure that what we are mandating is really working.
Your comments, but specifically regarding Senator Thomas's question, there are a number of studies that are out regarding the importance of preventative health care and looking at the dollars saved over time with early intervention. Particularly, I'm most aware of the studies that have been done looking at for children in terms of early developmental screening and identification of developmental delays and getting those children then into earlier intervention programs or private speech and language therapy, OT and physical therapy. And statistics that have been quoted in the past has been similar to what Dr. Brown had quoted: for every dollar provided in preventative or early identification, generally there's a consideration of $4 to $6 saved in the long run with early identification and then treatment. The American Academy of Pediatrics has long stood behind a scheduled routine visits that coincide with expected developmental targets of children. And in addition, the American Academy of Family Practice Physicians has also supported this, not only for the 10 visits as Senator McGuire has suggested in her bill for the first 24 months, but also a scheduled visit that follows toddlerhood, childhood, and the teen years. These visits include not only a full head-to-toe physical assessment, but screening for visual problems such as neonatal cataracts or amblyopia, dental caries, hearing loss, inappropriate weight gain or losses, suggesting overfeeding or underfeeding, any signs for physical abuse, mental health screening, and the state of bonding with the parents, as well as developmental milestones. The health supervision guidelines that have been developed and published by the Maternal Child Health Bureau in collaboration with several other national health care provider organizations recommends a comprehensive developmental approach to health supervision that includes not only physical assessment, but social, emotional, and cognitive components. And this approach is termed the Bright Futures component, offers a uniform standard of care for all children's health promotion. And as suggested by Dr. Brown, many of the state's Medicaid programs, including ours in Alaska, it's known as the Early Periodic Screening, Detection, and Treatment Program, have adopted these standards as a basis for program content. The American Academy of Pediatrics also recently published their recommendations that pediatric visits at age 18 months and 24 months as part of their developmental assessment should include universal screening specifically targeting autism spectrum disorders. Given the Center for Disease Control and Prevention estimations of 1 in 150 children who have autism spectrum disorder, the need to identify children early and assist in connecting them with treatment services, such as early intervention, is an important step to improve long-term outcomes. Obesity is a major health factor facing our country. Studies indicate that young children less than age 3 with weight over the 90th percentile are at risk for long-term obesity and overweight problems if their weight cannot be controlled with appropriate diet and exercise. Both of the American Academy of Pediatrics and Family Medicine recommend discussing weight and growth patterns with parents at each visit with a focused discussion for children who are about the 90th percentile or above at least at a year of age or 18 months. Parenting expectations and knowledge regarding developmental readiness and their correlation to abuse and neglect have been well noted in the literature. Health visits with providers are an opportune time to observe parental behaviors, answer questions, provide anticipatory guidance regarding parenting, as well as expectations for child safety, feeding, toilet training, management of inappropriate behaviors, and so on. These conversations are very inclusive of parents and other care providers and are part of a standard content in health supervision visits. A focused and structured time visit timed with developmental milestones in a child's life provides time for parents and their health care provider to discuss their child, hear their concerns, and be referred for problems if identified early. If children are only seen episodically for acute care problems in urgent care settings, which I might add frequently change depending upon a family's work schedule, frequently parents are reliant on emergency rooms, the child will not have the benefit of being seen when well, will generally not have a consistent provider looking at them, and the family will not benefit from the relationship that can develop between a healthcare provider and the development of a medical home for a long-term relationship. The Department of Health and Social Services supports Senate Bill 170 and the intent to promote health, detect problems early, and refer to appropriate providers for treatment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony. Also, I'd like to say that Dr. Butler is here for questions, or do you have a statement that you wanted to make today?
No statement.
That was just great what she did. Okay, we'll go back to the testimony then if there's no question of, did you have a question?
Just a quick one, Madam Chair. I'm trying to wrap my notion around the head on savings. I'm assuming when we talk about the savings that accrue because of this, we're talking about savings both to the state and to the insurer.
Stephanie, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Stephanie Burch. Yes, I think the savings, when we talk about savings, we talk about the fact that we've identified early. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be money saved the notion is that if you identify early, you save money perhaps in a much more expensive intervention. It's not to say that you won't spend any money at all, because frequently when you identify dental caries early, for example, in a child's mouth, you're going to have treatment that's going to be involved. But if you intervene early, when that child has cavities, you can probably save teeth and not require oral surgery under anesthesia that's going to require much more expensive intervention. One case I can typically share with you, since I work in the family as a family in the community as a family nurse practitioner, is the treatment for ear infections, commonly called otitis media. Because families typically, there are many families who have not seen the value of well-child visits or don't have the money. I have a lot of families who don't have the money to see a care provider. And so they shop around, and they have a history of a child who's had many, many ear infections without necessarily having care that's consistent or someone who can really evaluate that that child for hearing loss or speech delays as a result of that. And if they had one provider that they were going to that saw them on a periodic period of time when their child was well, some of those issues might have been caught earlier before the child gets to be school age. So those are the kinds of savings that we're talking about.
And I'm trying to parse out the words. So those savings accrue both to the private insurer and potentially to the state.
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you.
Is that all the questions? Okay, we have Denny DeWitt.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Denny DeWitt. I'm the Alaska Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. We are here opposing this particular piece of legislation for a number of reasons. And I'd like to clarify the issues. There have been two issues that have been discussed today. One is the issue of the services and whether they're a good idea and appropriate. Very few people would argue with that. The second is the question of who pays. And what this bill does is it assigns the payment responsibility to any employer that chooses to offer their employees and dependents health insurance. So what we're talking about here really is encouraging the state to intervene into how that limited pool of dollars that small employers have set aside for employee compensation are distributed. This is an issue that we think is best left to employees and employers as they're discussing what kind of compensation their employees wish to receive and how they wish to receive it. If you look at the study that was done by the legislative research, you'll find that about 49% of the children are covered by employer plans, about 4% by individual plans, and one would recognize that the individual plans will certainly be impacted by this, but a large percentage of those that are receiving coverage through employer plans are ERISA plans, which are not covered by this bill. Indeed, the state of Alaska, as the sponsor indicated, is a primary insurer in this state that does not provide benefits in this area. And this bill does not include the state of Alaska. It simply includes small employers who are not able to use ERISA plans. It's small employers that are trying to help provide some benefit for their employees. By the best guess that we have, it will increase the premium for those employers by somewhere between 1% and 3%. What we're seeing now is that many employers, particularly new small employers, are opting against health insurance, period, because of the cost. This simply adds bricks to the backpack and makes it more difficult for those folks that are wondering whether or not they can afford to offer health insurance plans. It's telling them that it's going to get more and more expensive, and it's driving them out of the market. So at the end of the day, we're seeing a 1% to 2% reduction annually in the number of small employers that are offering health insurance. So this is another one of those mandated issues that are causing small employers particularly not to be able to afford the kind of benefits that they'd like to offer to their employees. In terms, I'm not here to represent insurance companies, but I can tell you that insurance companies simply move money around. If it costs them X number of dollars for the benefits that are paid under the policy, that's returned to the premium payer in terms of payments. So to the extent that we're adding $150 or $250 a year, that's going to have to return to the people that are paying the premium. So that's either going to be the individual who is paying for an individual policy, or small employers who are covered under this. But again, I want to remind you that it would not impact the health benefit program offered by the state of Alaska. While the legislature, in my judgment, really is, in a corporate sense, the board of directors of the state of Alaska, and certainly ought to be making decisions for your employees. It seems ironic that we have legislation in front of you where you choose not to impact your own employees, but you choose to impact employers of small private businesses in the state of Alaska. We think that if we're talking about the state making an investment, that perhaps expanding the use of health clinics throughout the state and the state making an investment in those health clinics is a clearer and a more reasonable approach for the state to intervene in this area if, in fact, the state believes that this is an important benefit to be provided. The bill, while I appreciate the intent of the sponsor and a lot of the folks that have talked about it, simply requires a third party, a small third party, to pay the price of what appears to be some very good intentions. We think that's an inappropriate way to move forward on this particular idea of additional mandated coverage.
Thank you for your testimony. I'd like to just make this comment. I know that you're representing small businesses, and many of the small businesses don't provide insurance at all. They cannot afford it, and there is a problem there, and I would agree to that. But this bill, in the form that it is, would not interfere with them at this point. You know, it's just making it harder for them to decide that they can provide the insurance, and that is the area that we need to work on.
Madam
Chairman, we do have some bills that's out there that might address some of those issues.
We're trying to encourage our members to provide a good package of employee benefits. Each employer is trying to, within the ability of their operation, to provide compensation to consider that. What we're suggesting is that it's the old adage that, you know, there's a straw that'll break the camel's back. Each mandate that is put on makes it more difficult, as you indicate. And what we're seeing is that new business, new startup businesses particularly, are substantially less likely to offer health insurance. Those who offer health insurance are finding it's difficult, obviously, to get out of that commitment because it's part of what the compensation package is. But we're seeing some of them, and we don't know whether it's a large trend beginning or just a passing fancy, but we're seeing many small businesses move from providing insurance to providing an amount that people can use for insurance company that they secure on their own. The other problem you have in terms of this mandate is how it's designed and what the workforce is. If I have a small business and I employ five gentlemen who are 60 years old and who are single, it's my guess that when looking at how they would like their compensation package arranged, they would be less interested in having well baby coverage in their insurance benefit than they might having more income in their check. So again, it's not simply a question of whether or not this is a good benefit or it's a good thing for a group. The question is whether or not the state ought to interject itself in those discussions, which ultimately are a compensation issue.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I'd just like to go on record saying that's a policy decision that we would have to make. And as far as you're saying, leaving it up to the employer and the employee to make those decisions on what they cover, could you tell me if any of your small businesses that you know are discussing the issue to see if they were going to allow their employees to choose that as an option without a mandate being placed on them?
Madam Chairman, I can't tell you that.
If that's something that you could bring back to me, I would like that.
I will see what I can find out. We have some national data. One of the things the NFIB does is they have two kinds of surveys. We have our annual, what we call our ballot, yes, where we send out, you know, here's a policy, what do you think of it? We also have surveying that says, have you done this? Why did you do this?
Yes.
And the questions that we have had on the why are you doing this are not specific to well baby visits, but they have been generally in the area of mandates, which is where I get some of the information that I've been sharing with you, that our folks are looking at mandates and the cost of mandates, and that's causing them to back off. So I can't give you a specific answer.
That's fine.
On this one, but I can give you the general answer. The other thing that, if I might, very
quickly. We are really, okay. One more statement maybe if you think it's pertinent, or you may put it in writing to us, but
let me make a very, very brief comment, and that is there's a difference between insurance and prepayment. And insurance is when a large group of folks get together, put money together to indemnify themselves against an unusual occurrence. That's much cheaper. Prepayment is when you say, you can go do these things, what's it going to cost us? And we're really moving philosophically from an insurance model to a prepayment model. And I can tell you that the prepayment model will always be more expensive than the insurance model, just in terms of premium. And that's kind of where we're moving to.
Are there any, I'm sorry, I didn't see your hand. But
that's fine, Madam Chair. Dennis, I had asked a question of the person who testified previously about whether savings accrue to the insurance companies, and the response, if I could take the risk of summarizing it, is they suggested yes, that's true. And a bad habit that I have is I take notes. And you kind of began your testimony by saying, by best guess, we believe that there will be additional costs that accrue to the small businesses. I need to see, I guess. You know, I think it's always, we're always going to hear from the insurance company as they sit down and they negotiate with group employers. We're always going to hear them say, well, there's now new mandates and it's going to cost us more. But do you have anything other than a best guess that suggests that, in fact, insurance premiums will go up and that there will be no savings to the insurer by doing healthy baby exams?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I got the 1-3% estimate from the Council of Affordable Health Insurance, and I'll be happy to make a copy of that report available to you.
Is that on well baby exams?
Yes.
Okay. I'd love to see that.
Why don't you just give that to the whole committee? I would appreciate that.
I'll be happy to do that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yeah.
Senator Dice.
I'd just like to add a comment here to Senator Elton's question. I have on my own thinking about all this kind of in evolution, and I've asked the very question before. And if indeed, as the proponents of mandates say, that this is a good investment, invest some money now and you're going to save it in the long term, then I ask the question, why aren't the insurance companies jumping on board and doing this for their own interest? And there's not been a good answer to that. And it makes me think that either they're very short-sighted or that they're not clear that it pencils out for them. And we've been doing an awful lot of research in my office about how do we drive down the cost of medical care and how do we make it more available for most people and stuff. Certainly one thing I'm confident that we've found is that the cost of insurance is higher in the jurisdictions that have the most mandates, and which seems to contradict what some of the testimony we hear. And that that's pretty universal. We could hear from Jeremy, my staff here, but we've looked at a lot of states, and indeed, if we want to have insurance more available, as in less costly and more available to people at the lower end of the economic spectrum, then having less mandates seems to be one of the ways to do that. And where those crossover lines are, but I think that the insurance companies, most of whom are very good at making money and looking after their own financial interests, would be able to figure that out. And I'm convinced what I just said is true. I'm not sure what it means.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I appreciate that point of view, and because it is a complex arena, and the one thing that kind of points the other way is those employers like the city and borough of Juneau, who has been doing this for a long period of time, that encourages healthy kinds of behavior, including preventative kinds of stuff, have lowered their health care costs. So it is a mix out there. And I don't want to sound like I don't trust the insurance industry, but I think they look for every excuse that they possibly can to raise their profit margins. And I think that sometimes we hear mandate, and I hear profit margin, because it's another reason for them to change the cost of the service that they provide. I'm suspicious.
And if I may, I could infer from what you just said that maybe the insurance industry wants us to put more mandates on so they can have a reason to raise the charges. We have to get back to our old discussion about who's the most cynical around here.
Okay, let's move right along here. Did you have a question or comment?
No. We could go on all based on percentages.
No, we don't want to do that. We do have a Dr. Jody Budo. Are you online?
Yes, I am.
Would you state your name and your affiliation, please?
Dr. Jodine Budo.
Yes.
I'm a pediatrician in Anchorage, and I am president of the Alaska chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Yes. You want to make a statement?
And yes, I in the American Academy of Pediatrics has already been testified is very much in support of well baby visits and requiring insurance companies to cover well baby visits. A couple of points that we wanted to make. First of all, about the insurance company, one of the things that I see is they like to get their money now, and they're banking on the fact that they're going to get paid for services now, and the savings is going to come later on. However, by that time, people have changed insurance, and so it's somebody else that isn't having to pay later while they still got the money. Does that make sense?
I would let somebody speak to that. I hear what you're saying. Yes? You want to continue?
Yes. And one of the other things that we have some PROMS data, and PROMS is the, pregnancy... pregnancy risk assessment monitoring system, and one of the things that has come up when they've done data analysis for why children haven't gotten their well visits from 2004 data to 2006, if you didn't get a well baby checkup, why not? And the thing with the most significant difference from 2004 to 2006 is I didn't have enough money or insurance to pay for it, and it went from about 5.1 to 23.4 percent of people that, checking that is applying to them. And part of that reason is because of Denali KidCare, more and more children weren't covered by Denali KidCare, and then not having any insurance, and so children are falling through the cracks and not getting coverage that is needed for us to provide them with the best care.
All right. Does that complete your testimony?
Yes.
All right. Senator Dyson?
Thank you.
thanks for calling in and the work you do. This will seem like a adversarial question, but
that's okay.
Well, and don't take it personal, but I wonder why you and others aren't saying we ought to put the mandate on the parents that every parent has a responsibility to get their kids tested and analyzed, as opposed to a third party like this.
Well, I think the way that I'm reading the bill and the legislation is that it's requiring insurance companies to provide coverage for these visits, and I do ask my families to come in for well visits, and I know the doctor that testified earlier, I'm blanking on who it was. You know, we don't turn someone away from ability to pay, and we do make it a point to, I do make it a point to tell them that if they can't pay, I still want to see them, and we will work out, you know, the payment issue as best we can. We will work with them in any way possible. And I do ask that my families come in for their well visits.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and I don't doubt it a bit. I should have asked the question and said, would you support us putting a legal mandate on every parent that they have their child have a well baby a test and analysis during their first year?
Yeah, I'm not sure how that would be as easily enforced as you can't go door to door and say, did you take your baby to their well visit this week? Whereas if you require insurance companies, if they want to do business here, that part of doing business in Alaska is providing preventative care, then it just is.
Yeah, I appreciate that there's an enforcement issue. We have an almost foolproof one. You don't get your baby tested, you don't get a dividend. And that's been almost universally successful in changing human behavior in our state. But, but it is more the philosophical thing. Whose responsibility is it? And I appreciate your answer, and thanks for testifying today.
Did anyone else have a question? That completes the public testimony on the list that I have. There is some other discussion that need to be made at this time. The one thing, you know, we heard this bill in Labor and Commerce. They passed that bill along to, and I'd like for the sponsors of the bill to come back to the table. And maybe we need to address the insurance provided by the state. We are self-insured, but we contract out to somebody else to carried out. It's probably not as simple as we thought it was to mandate that they do it. And I don't know if you're in the position to speak to the wall that we ran up against. We do have somebody from insurance here, or we could, you know, briefly talk about that. I don't know how we could take care of that problem that we ran into within a timely manner. I thought of maybe doing a letter of intent saying what the plan is to try to bring them aboard. People don't always follow the mandates that are given, but I know no other way that we could handle this problem at this time. If you say we're holding it up because we're only asking the private sector to do it and not our own, we are very much interested in the state doing it also.
Yes.
And I know you, as a chair of the sponsor of this bill, you are interested in it also. Would you like to speak to some of the issues that we ran up against?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair. Before I speak to that, I want to make one response to something Senator Dyson said, and that is, who has the responsibility? And it certainly is the parents, but it's all of us. And I think that's what I'm trying to say in the bill. You know, many people in this building talk a lot about lives of children and the fact that they're important, that they are sacred, that they ought to exist. But then when it comes time to make those hard steps to take care of those children that are among us and a part of our civilization, it's always interesting to me how some folks tend to back away and then sort of say, well, it's someone else's responsibility. So I would simply say, it's all of our responsibilities, and it's to all of our benefit. And then moving forward, on the issue of state coverage, Madam Chair, it's very important to me. And I, of the few things I supported that Denny DeWitt said, that's one of them. I think he's absolutely right. I'll have my aide go into the details, but there are multiple sections of state law that would have to be changed. It's never been done before. That's not to say that I'm unafraid to take on the battle. My thought would be, from a practical point of view, would be that we go forward. I love the idea of a letter of intent. We go forward with the bill that we have now so that we can get it through. We have the letter of intent, and we put that pressure on our provider, and then give it a year. And that pressure would be that if they don't really listen to that, that we could come back next year. And I'm unafraid to go through every section that would need to be changed to do that. Did you want to speak to some of the?
Yes, Madam Chair, if I may add to that.
Yes, you may.
For the record, my name is Trevor Fulton. I'm staff for Senator McGuire. As Senator McGuire mentioned, there is a long list of coverages that are already mandated under Alaska statute. And it's important to note that historically, every one of those mandated coverages, the state has picked up. We have started covering. So while we maybe, I wouldn't want to overstep my bounds and say that we can be assured the state would fall in line with the mandated coverage on private carriers, what we can say is we see no reason why they wouldn't.
Hello.
And we do have somebody online who could probably speak or clarify that a little more if need be, and that's Katie Campbell, and she's from the Division of
Insurance. Katie Kinwar?
Campbell.
Campbell. Are you online? Katie Campbell?
Yeah.
Oh, you're here?
Yeah.
You're in the room. Okay. Would you come forward, please, if you want to speak to that?
Yes, my name is Katie Campbell. I'm the life and health actuary with the Division of Insurance, and I honestly can't speak to the state of Alaska. I'm covered under it, and that's about all I can tell you about that. Historically, they have covered the mandates, but our insurance laws do not apply to the state of Alaska plan, which is what I
Yeah, we're fully aware of that. The question that I do have also, though, you said you were covered under the plan. Last year, we had the director of insurance to come forward, and she stated the same statement that was given by Senator McGuire on some of the problems that we would have doing that. But could you answer this question? Most of the mandates that we have made in that area has to do with Medicaid, Medicare issues more so than anything else that they mandated. You know, some of those things go on that list that you have. Sometimes you put one on the list, something else comes off. Is that the list that you were referring to? The list of mandates?
No, I was referring to the insurance mandates that are in Title 21 that apply to the insurance companies, which is what this bill would add a mandate to that statute, which only applies to insurance companies. It would not apply to Medicaid or any other government program.
Okay. And you do have a list of all the ones that refer only to the private insurance mandates that have been made?
We don't actually have a nice little complete list, but they're all in 2142. All of our mandates
okay.
are.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Elton.
And Katie, maybe you can answer this, maybe not, but you can maybe get back to us. I mean, it would seem to me that that the mandates that apply elsewhere, I mean, are those part of when we contract with a provider, a coverer? I mean, are those part of the do we handle those in the contract, those mandates, or is that something that is just kind of left up to the provider to either do or not do?
Through the chair, the answer to that would really depend on what group you're looking at. If you're talking about large employers like the state of Alaska or the largest employers in the state that self-fund their health plans, it's all negotiated with the insurance company. They self-fund their plan, so they decide what benefits they're going to offer. On the small employer side, Those are packaged plans normally. Those plans, we approve those benefit plans in this in our division. And so we review the contracts, make sure all the mandated benefits are in there. And then the insurance companies really, they survey, they're always in tune with their market through brokers or whatever to find out what the needs of that market is. And they adjust their benefit plans quite regularly. But what we do is we review those and then we make sure the mandates are included.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I think that maybe a letter of intent is a good idea, and I think maybe perhaps we ought to consider having as part of the letter of intent that this is a mandate we're applying to the private sector, and it ought to be part of the contract negotiations or the solicitation for bids.
And that was the idea that I had. So
yeah, because the contracts, I think, are coming up within a year. Yeah. So this might be a good time to do that if there is a letter of intent.
I guess what I could ask, if that's the way that the committee would like to go, we could start drafting up a letter of intent. Other than that, is there any other concerns that we have about this particular bill that's before us?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Well, I'm trying not to take personal what Senator McGuire said.
Please don't.
And but this business about backing off from, you know, taking personal responsibility or doing something, you know, each of us and each of our families has to answer for what we have personally done. And certainly me and my family could have done more, but it's been a fair bit, and I mean, it's ongoing. But I just remind us here that we are not, by passing this bill, signing up that any of us personally are going to do anything. We're not going to pay anything more. We're not going to go out and take desperate children into our home or write checks to pay for them to get this kind of care. What we're saying is somebody else will. And I'm not sure that fits this definition of backing off. And we always have a responsibility to be really careful about the decisions we make. And I would encourage us to be very particularly careful about what we do that spends somebody else's money and assuming responsibility for others.
Thanks for your comment. What I'd like to say about that, you're right that we're probably not going to be adding any money out there to make this happen. But there is no piece of legislation that's going to come before us is going to cover every need that need to be met. And we have to make some priorities of what's important to us. And what's important to me is what can we do for our children right from the beginning? Not after they get sick and need the help, or not after they are grown and need the help, but what can we do in the early stages? And, you know, we're moving towards that self-responsibility. We're talking that all over the place. We got a bill out there now that the governor has introduced, her transparency bill. We got 160 out there that people are talking about what we can do. And we're not going to meet those needs in just one piece of legislation. So I hope that we will not decide to move on this one simply because it might cause some other people to look at having to look at their plan and rework it, because they will work it out. And if it takes more small business out of the loop, I hope that we'll be able to come along with something else that would allow them to come back in. So what is the wishes of the committee on 170? Yes, Senator Dyson. I mean, Senator Thomas.
Thank you.
You can let Senator Dyson comment as well too.
I compliment.
Maybe he's had enough.
Wait for a while.
I too would spend somebody else's money to make sure that as we move this measure forward to gather up some of that research so the state has that in hand to make sure that we're, you know, operating on good information, as well as. As Senator Elton mentioned, that the city borough of Juneau has and I'm sure they probably initiated wellness programs and stuff within their.
And you know, we could bring back to the committee because it has to go to finance. In the meantime, we could gather up other information of some of the boroughs and cities that are providing this in their insurance plans.
I'm not sure what time you wanted to take to do that, and I'm supportive of the bill, but also would like to at least remove some of the myths that maybe exist or don't exist that we're operating on. So that's why I suggest the research be kind of accumulated and put in conjunction with the bill, and as well as what others have done to successfully stave off the cost, because I believe the insurance companies will simply shift it around, and if they say, well, it's, you know, we don't know if we're going to be insuring this group at a later date, they just switch around. It's the same insurance companies rolling around, so they all have benefit of that same operation taking place, but they pick and choose the statement that they would make, and obviously it's a percentage business, so the more that's spent, the more that you get. So that's how their income works. So anyhow, and I would not expect the National Federation of Independent Business to be particularly supportive of these types of mandates, because they are obviously not convinced that there's the savings that take place in the future on it. So I'm not sure what you want to do. I don't know if you want to hold the bill and get some more information, or if you'd rather move it forward to the...
It is not my desire to hold the bill to get the information, but I would say to the committee that I would prepare a letter of intent to go with the letter when we get it to finance. Then if there's anything else that need to be done, it should be from a financial standpoint and not from a health standpoint.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, I appreciate this. It's a dilemma for me. And I'd be comfortable if we were saying, yep, this is important, and the state will subsidize every family that's below whatever level of the poverty level you want to say, and we give them the $1,500 to make sure that the newborn kids get it. And instead of putting this as a mandate on the insurance companies and the small businesses. And the same way I thought Governor Frank was going to hear 2 years ago say, yep, we're going to solve the cost shifting that happens from emergency rooms by the state paying for the indigent who get their care in the emergency room instead of those costs getting shifted to other ones. But we're not addressing the fundamental issues here that are really anomalies in this. So I wish we were. And if this bill was modified so that we had an honest fiscal note that said, yep, $1,500 for every new kid or every $1,100 or whatever it is, and we believe it so strongly that we pay it, I'd be in favor of it. But anyways, you guys want to pass the bill on, and I appreciate the intentions.
Senator Elton?
This is a learning process for me, and Senator Dyson helps me learn. I mean, the one thing that I would just suggest is that I don't see it as much as a cost shifting as he does. I see this. I, for one, am convinced by the notion that has been testified to that, yes, there is an upfront cost, and we can identify what that upfront cost is. I mean, we've talked about it here, someplace between $125, maybe $250 per visit. And so we know what that cost is. But the problem with Senator Dyson's suggestion that, well, maybe we should just be honest and we should just pay that cost, is that there's no way to recover the savings. And I do believe that there are savings with early discovery of problems. I do acknowledge that there is an upfront cost. I do acknowledge that it's not us that will be paying for it. But there are downstream savings that accrue to the parents. Generally in this case, and I think there are downstream savings that accrue to the insurance industries. They might not acknowledge it because I'm sure they're going to do everything they can to say this is a mandate, you got to pay for it. But that speaks, I think, to the profit margin and not to the suggestion that we've heard already that by paying some of these smaller upfront costs, we're saving, you know, money downstream. So that's the only place, I guess, that I would divert from Senator Dyson's suggestion that we go ahead and pay the costs, because we will accrue savings, parents will accrue savings, and so it's just a difficult notion for me to accept, but I want to thank him for making me think about it.
If I may.
All right. Briefly, yes.
Well,
to his comment, you may speak to that briefly.
I think your own argument defeats itself. If indeed we help children of poor families get the care they need, then that child will have much better incomes and is far less likely to be a burden on the public health costs in the future, and that family is much less likely to have catastrophic child-related health problems. And indeed, if both the child and the family grow to the point where they are able to take care of all of their own medical bills and not be in the lower thing, everybody wins. And we, the state, who, you know, all feel some responsibility, will be one of the beneficiaries, but we will have more well children and more families less burdened by it. But it's a guess. I mean, Yes, sir.
Just to speak to that, and then I'm going to ask the sponsor of the bill to come back up. If we are concerned about the poor kids, the families that can't afford it, and also fit into the Medicaid or Medicare realm of it, Denali Kid Care, we don't even have slots filled for what we can afford. So there has to be some people out there working on that to make sure that we do everything we can. We got a bill out there. You want to do something for all the poor kids? There's a bill out there to say, provide health care for all our children. Sitting right up in finance, no. And I guess we shouldn't be talking about bills in another committee, but it came through here. There's all kinds of ways that we can address the poor people. What about those families that are out there struggling that's above that and can't afford to have? We have to think about them also. So I've said to you what I would like to see happen with your bill. I'd just like to hear from you if you think that's the direction you'd like to go in, and then I will entertain a motion to that effect once I hear from you.
Thank you, Senator Davis and Senator Dyson. I apologize if you took offense to my comments. I made them with fervency because being 8 years in this building, every once in a while I observe a disconnect. And it's not one that I've observed personally with you. It's something that simply does occur, where we talk a lot about the health and well-being of our future, of our children, of those folks that will make up our civilization. And then we don't always follow through with some of the steps that we could take to help. And so it wasn't aimed at you. It was more a statement about who is responsible. And I think it's all of us that are responsible. I would ask the committee to pass the bill on. I think there's a couple other points I want to add about it. When the diabetes bill and the colorectal cancer bill were moving through, the same arguments were made about prevention, about treatment. What happens when a diabetic does not get the life-saving day-to-day treatment? Eventually, their toes fall off. Eventually, they lose sight. And someone has to pay the bill for that. If they're an insurance system, the insurance company will pay. If they end up out of an insurance company, then we pay as a state, as a nation, and certainly in our healthcare costs that are redirected to us. Same with colorectal cancer screening. And I would just make the same argument for well baby exams. It's a similar kind of analysis that you can go through in your mind. If you just take a child's life from inception to the end, if you have life-saving, disease-preventing intervention in the early years, you are going to, by definition, prevent some of those more catastrophic things that could occur in the end. It's true that it might not be the same insurance company, and so they may not, as the doctor articulated earlier, they may not be able to run that through an actuarial because they want their money now. But I think it's our jobs as policymakers to go up to 30,000 feet and say somebody will pay that cost in the end. And it likely could be the state. It certainly could be the state's checkbook that we manage. It could be another insurance company. So if you don't want to think about the social arguments, the benefits of well babies, you could just simply think of it from that standpoint. The other thing that I think is that one of the roles of policymakers that I've observed is we make strong statements in our statutes about the things that we think are really important, and I always kind of describe it as the fabric of our community and our civilizations, the things we don't want to have happen, we want to discourage, and the things that we want to encourage. And it's our moral fabric, it's our society, we get a chance to say what we think. And I think in passing a bill like this, we may only start with 15% of the insurance companies because that's who we can reach, because ERISA has, you know, mandated a federal exclusion around it, and because with the state we're having some difficulty. But it's a strong statement that we believe that the health and well-being of children is important to us, important enough to put it in one of our books. And I think it will make a difference. I think that, as Trevor has indicated, there isn't a single statement that we have made in the form of a mandate that has not been adopted by the state of Alaska. So I think the state of Alaska certainly pays attention in its negotiations.
Senator.
And the last thing I want to say?
I don't want you to talk your bill to death here. We've got 15 minutes and you have another bill on the docket.
Last thing I was going to say is that I think we might help in negotiations. I'm not sure that the folks sitting at the table are always as well armed against some of the companies. So I think legislation like this could be helpful.
Thank you for your comments. I think I hear in all that that you do want to move forward on the bill. And what I propose to the committee is that my staff and your staff will get together to do that letter of intent and make sure that the copy gets out to everyone also, and send it along to the finance with this. So we have time to do that. Could I have a motion? Yes, Senator Elton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we move committee substitute for Senate Bill 170 from backslash version E with the attached zero fiscal note from committee with the notation that the chair is going to include a letter of intent. And I'll just object for a quick statement, Madam Chair. I think that the sponsor has a good idea of the kind of information that's going to be needed when we talk about cost benefits for the next committee. And so I feel comfortable making the motion. With that, I withdraw my objection.
All right. Is there any objection for this bill to go forward? Should we call the roll?
I don't think you need to.
We don't need to?
Unless you
have an
objection.
Nope. All right. No objection. The bill will move forward then. Thank you very much, and thanks to the committee. We do have another bill. If you're ready to take it up, it's Senate Bill 181. Who's going to do the overview on this bill, Senator?
Just briefly, this bill is not as interesting.
Right.
Senate Bill 181 actually just updates our statutes with respect to anatomical gifts. We, as you know, Senator, we have we've led the nation in our laws pertaining to organ and tissue donation and transplantation. And what this bill would do is update our statutes to harmonize the anatomical gift laws. And there, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over because I'm needed in judiciary. But I'm going to let him outline it, and perhaps even once he outlines it, questions would be a better place to start. There are three folks.
And actually, there's nothing coming forth more than the recommendation of the changes that's on the first page of the summary changes.
There isn't, to my knowledge, exactly, Madam Chair, and there isn't anything controversial in this bill. All of the things that have been controversial about tissue and organ donation in years past are still on the books. This is really more of a technical bill, and so I'll let my staff. Okay.
And we do have somebody from DMV online to speak to that bill. Yes?
Madam Chair, I'll go ahead and just outline a couple more points about the bill, and then if it's okay with you. We do have several people online that have been waiting for a while. I would ask that we could give them a quick few minutes.
I will give them the time. I just need you to run through quickly what you have to say.
In that case, I will.
Okay.
Run through quickly. As Senator McGuire mentioned, this bill is based on the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, which is a federal piece of legislation that aims to harmonize the anatomical gift laws over all 50 states. Essentially, it aims to facilitate organ and tissue donation and transplantation, aims to remove obstacles in the donation process, and it aims to increase participation in organ donor programs. And if you'll notice in your packet, there are two versions of the bill in front of you. We do have a blank committee substitute for this committee that we are asking be adopted. And the blank committee substitute came out of discussions with the Department of Law and the Department of Health and Social Services, and they do concur with all of those changes. We have people available to address any questions.
Are we referring to E? Is that
yes,
the one?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Version Echo.
Okay, would somebody say that we accept this as our working document?
I move that we accept committee substitute Senate Bill 181/E as the working document.
No objections, then we'll continue.
And at that, since we are pressed for time, I would prefer to open it up for questions.
Okay, before we get to a question, we're going to go on and take the public testimony while we have them there. Whitney Brewster, are you there for comments or just questions?
Madam Chairman, for the sake of time, I am here. I'm available for questions.
If it's something that you think we need to hear, you have time to say that.
For the record, my name is Whitney Brewster, DMV Director. Just something that I would like clarification on how the DMV is to implement for clarification purposes, how we deal with potential donors who are under 18. Right now, someone under 18 has to have parental consent to apply for an instruction permit, provisional license, driver's license, and it's on the same form as the question as to whether or not the applicant wants to be a donor. This bill, it appears that Section 4 speaks to how old a donor can be, and I would just like verification on how we are to deal with donors. Is it okay with us not to have parental consent prior to that checking that box?
I'm looking for Section 4. What page it is on the bill? Do you have that bill in front of you?
Yes, ma'am.
That's on page
Section 14,
page
on
two.
Page 4.
Four. Section 14, you said.
Yes, ma'am.
Did you say 14?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I'm there. And what changes is that making for you?
On line 17, subsection B, authorized under state law to apply for a driver's license because the donor is at least 16 years of age.
But that's in the language already. That's not new added to that. Is that a new section added? Oh, yes, it is. New section added. I'm not able to speak to that. I guess we'd have to get somebody, Department of Law.
Madam Chair.
That. Yes?
If I may.
This is Deborah Baer, and I'm employed by the Alaska Department of Law. I'm also a uniform law commissioner for the state
okay.
of Alaska.
Thank you.
And I think the answer to Ms. Brewster's question is, you first have to have permission to drive from your parents before you can check off the box whether or not you need to donate. So if a parent did not want their child to drive, the kid can't drive and can't check off the box. If the parent agrees for the child to drive, when it comes to the decision on anatomical gifts, the child gets to make that decision, but there is a provision later that says a parent can revoke it if a child dies before age 18. So at time of death, if a parent said, that's not the way I want to go, a revocation is appropriate. But it doesn't change driver's license law in the state. If you are not eligible to drive without parental consent, this bill does not change that.
We're glad you were here. Thank you.
Thanks.
J-
Yeah, wait just a minute, please. Senator Thomas?
Just prior to that, it says emancipated, or emancipated meaning the age of 18 then in that case in the state of Alaska, or?
Emancipated means that a court came in and decided that through a court action that you are able to live on your own, and oftentimes we'll find children whose parents have died, they're 17 years old, they're able to work, take care of themselves, the court will come in and emancipate them. There's other ways you can get emancipated in the state, but that's the more likely one.
But 18 would be the age then for
And you can get emancipated under 18. Excuse me, through the chair, you can get emancipated under 18.
Just to make your own decision then. We forget about the emancipated.
Okay. Age of majority in the state is 18.
Okay, that's the answer. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, Senator Calgary.
Yeah, I'd like to ask about on referring up to page 8, line 31, part of the bill, that part of the bill outlines who may make a gift to a descendant's body or part. It says any other person having the authority to dispose of the descendant's body, who do you see as that covering? My concern is that maybe a funeral home or someone you contact to take care of the funeral service. Do they have that authority?
Just a minute, she will speak to that.
This is Deborah Baer from the Department of Law. The any other person having authority, you'd have to have legal authority to be able to dispose of the person's the person's body. So, for example, the ones that I'm thinking about are people like the medical examiner at some point has legal authority to dispose of the body, and that would address that. This bill does not create legal authority that is not somewhere else under state law.
All right, thank you. Okay, any other questions?
One more.
Yes.
This concern with other versions of the UAVA organ donation that would effectively trump a living will, in which case a person elects not to have life support. This would be, in most cases, you must keep an individual on life support in order to keep the organs viable for transport. How do we address that issue?
I think you better sit there for a while.
This is Deborah Baer with the Alaska Department of Law. There's been some confusion with this bill, but the bill basically says if you're on life support and you have expressed a wish to donate, where it says do not resuscitate, they will still honor your do not resuscitate order. But if the doctor is under some concern as to how whether to keep you going in order to honor both your wishes that you want to donate, this bill clarifies that they can keep you available to the time that the organ donation organization can get look at the documents and have the doctor perform the proceeding. But it's not trying to trump if a person says I do not wish to donate an organ. It's very clear they can say that, and the medical professionals will honor that.
If a person elects not to have life support, is that the same thing as saying do not wish to donate?
It's Deborah Baer from Law. I believe they're two separate decisions. There's a lot of people in this world that have signed do not resuscitate orders. I know a lot of people in nursing homes have. But they can also check a box to donate organs. So I think they're two separate decisions that a patient would have to make with their doctor or their legal advisor.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. We do have two other people that signed up to speak to that bill. Bruce, I'm not able to pronounce your last name. I won't try. Are you there? Is there Bruce online to speak to this bill, 181?
Yeah, I'm on the line. It's Bruce Elmerides here. Thank you.
You may testify.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to state my name is Bruce Elmerides. I am CEO of Life Alaska Donor Services. We're the organ and tissue donor program for the state of Alaska. And I'd just like to state that there are close to 100,000 people waiting for an organ transplant in the United States and about 180 patients waiting in Alaska. 18 people in the United States die each day, while waiting for an organ transplant, and it's important to simplify and clarify the process of becoming an organ and tissue donor. SB 181 by updating Alaska's UAGA Uniform Anatomical Gift Act to the 2006 version from the 1987 version will remove obstacles to organ and tissue donation by clarifying language on who can grant consent to organ donation. It recognizes the benefits of donor registries, of which we have a donor registry in Alaska, which now has just surpassed 300,000 citizens in the state of Alaska, continues to grow at about 800 per week, mostly through the Department of Motor Vehicle Signups. The revised version also prioritizes donation for transplantation over research. SB 181 also further improves the relationship between the donation organizations and the medical examiner's office. The medical examiner plays a key role in donation, as most organ and tissue donations involve sudden, unexpected deaths, which fall under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, is there Sherry Morano? Sherry?
She was in Anchorage. She left.
I'm sorry, we missed her. Is there anyone else online that want to speak to this bill? Is there anyone in the audience? Okay. That brings us back before us. So is there any statements to be made or questions to ask of the sponsor at this time?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
There's lots of things I admire about the sponsor of this bill, not the least of which is she never quits. She's been working this issue ever since I've been here. And I appreciate the work she's done. And also, just say parenthetically, I could have a conflict of interest here. My oldest daughter, for all of my children's adult lives, I've been dragging cars out of the wrecking yard and rebuilding them, giving to my kids. And in order to honor that tradition, my oldest daughter has said, "Take good care of yourself, Dad, because when you get to the end of your life, we're going to part you out." And sell the pieces to the highest bidder, and which is not disrespectful given her. But if you're ready for a motion,
I'm ready for a motion, Senator Dyson.
Chair, I move that we move this bill from committee with individual recommendations.
And there's zero fiscal note on this
zero
bill.
Zero fiscal note.
Thank you very much. Hear no objection. Then R-181 will move from this committee. Does it go to finance?
Goes
is
to
there another place of referral?
State Affairs and Judiciary.
State Affairs, okay.
Yes, thank you. Senator.
To the next committee of referral. That completes our agenda for today, and I thank you for your consideration. And make sure that you sign the book before you leave. Dr. Butler.
Do I get your break?